Dublab. Welcome to The Quarantine Tapes, a daily podcast from Onassis, LA and Dublab. Hosted by Paul Holdengraber, this series chronicles shifting paradigms in the era of social distancing.
Greetings. This is Paul Holdengraber, your host for The Quarantine Tapes, brought to you by Onassis, LA and Dublab. I am thrilled to announce that we have asked various former Quarantine Tape guests to host during a week guests of their own choice in total freedom. They have absolute carte blanche on their choices. This week, I have asked Eddie Glaude, the distinguished university professor in the Department of African American Studies at Princeton University, to be our host. Eddie Glaude is the author, most recently, of the extraordinary study on James Baldwin, entitled Begin Again, James Baldwin's America and its Urgent Lessons for Our Own. I hope you will enjoy these quarantine tapes.
I am so delighted to have the opportunity, the blessing to talk with Bishop William Barber, the co-chair of the Poor People's Campaign, who is in many ways the leading moral and prophetic voice of our times. It's a blessing to have an opportunity to talk with you, Doc. And I want to begin with a basic question, you know, a question that our mamas would ask us when they first saw us. How you doing? How you holding up in these times, man?
You know, that is the question. I think about that question more, Eddie, now than ever. I did not understand when they used to ask it what they were really saying. It is an existential question that has so many layers to it. You know, when grandma would say, how you doing? How you really doing? You know, they were thinking about how you doing with all of this racism. How you doing when we know you got more bills than you got money? How you doing when we know that you may have sicknesses, but you can't go to the doctor because you don't have health care? You know, how you doing in your spirit? How are you doing with your anger? Because every now and then, this constant disparities of race and class will just make you pure tea angry. How am I doing? You know, I don't know if there is a answer. You know, I'm thankful in many ways and yet brokenhearted, distressed. I've got one member of my family, the church family, that's lost 12 members of their family in COVID. I got another people I can think about in the Poor People's Campaign, one young lady, 18 years old, lost 11 family members within a 30-mile radius in Mississippi. I can't cry. I run out of tears. I don't know where I am. And yet I see people helping one another. And as my grandma used to say, hoping one another. And that inspires me. I'm not lost hope, because hope deals with despair. It doesn't run around it. I have my own struggles. As you know, I fought with ankylosing spondylitis before this pandemic. And I have an immune deficiency. So I've really been locked in. And yet the election has buoyed my spirit to some degree. Then I hear certain comments post-election and I say, oh Lord, I thought we were stepping forward a little bit, you know? So how am I doing? I'm ebbing and flowing, Doc. I'm like a buoy on the water, you know, and some days I'm up and some days I'm down.
What do you reach for when you're down? What do you reach for when your spirits are low, Doc?
Yeah, I reach for grandma. I reach for granddad. I've been spending a lot of time with the cloud of witnesses. I found that I could not merely talk to people who were living. I had to spend some time in the spirit with people who went through worse than we faced. Mm-hmm. So I've had to spend some time with Frederick Douglass after the Dred Scott decision and read his writing. I've had to spend some time with Harriet Tubman and wonder what it was like to fall out with epilepsy, knowing that the dogs were behind you. Wow. And all you could do was trust God. I've had to spend some time with William Lloyd Garrison, who was arrested. And one day he wrote on the wall, I, William Lloyd Garrison, was arrested for the damnable sin of preaching that all men are created equal. And he was white. You know, I've wrestled with, what did the family of Vialawusa do when they heard she had been shot less than an hour after the end of the sermon? So I've been spending time now with the cloud of witnesses, because my faith tells me that when you're running a race, you know, Paul wrote to the Hebrew people, he said, don't ever forget there's this great cloud of witnesses that's cheering you on. They're the martyrs, the sufferers. And it keeps you from thinking that your moment is like the worst moment ever. You know, to deal with this moment, I had to go back and deal with some folk that dealt with slavery. And sometimes they just slapped me in the spirit and said, come on here now.
Don't get it twisted.
Now, I know you're mad and I know you're talking about, but come on now. We dealt with 250 years, you know.
Right,
or sometimes I have to go back and deal. I'm like, what are those? Like the fact that Red Summer happened in the middle of a pandemic.
Mm-hmm.
When we had another lying, narcissistic president who happened to be educated and the former president of Princeton. I mean, that's the truth.
It is.
You know, he was lying and playing Birth of a Nation in the Oval Office 100 years before Bannon. He lied about a pandemic, got 650,000 people killed. He himself got it and almost died, and then he still wouldn't own it. And then right in the middle of that, you get Red Summer with folk deciding that they're going to run black folk out of communities and try to stifle the courage that they had garnered in World War I. So sometimes, Doc, by listening to those who have run a race before, history, spending time with them, it actually brings life to the present moment for me.
Yeah,
it gets me back up. You know, I can almost sense their hands saying, boy, you better get up. Mm-hmm. This is just your time. We had our Edmunds Pettus Bridge. We had our abolition. We had our slavery. So just get up.
You know, I wanted to begin there because so many people look to you. And, you know, folks are constantly grabbing on you, even me asking you to do this interview. And, you know, folks are not only in terms of your ministry at the church, you know, you are pastor for the nation in so many ways. And so folks are constantly expecting you to offer words. And you know, sometimes we just got to ask how you holding up. I was thinking the other day, Doc, in the midst of, you know, that horrific number of over 3,000 dead in one day.
Yeah.
And I was thinking about Dr. King when he eulogized those babies after the bombing of 16th Street Baptist Church. And you know, you remember how he walked out of that church, how he was almost bent over. The weight of it all.
Mm-hmm.
Was on his shoulders. And you are on the front lines. You are in the shadows, in the places that folk don't want to see.
Mm-hmm.
And you have to bear the burden of that. So I wanted to begin there, but I also want you to give us a sense of where you think we are as a nation in the midst of this holiday season. You know, everybody's getting their gifts and putting up the trees and the lights and doing all the things that they do. Where do you think we are? Where do you think we are now in this moment?
And, you know, when you think about that, yeah, he was bent over. And part of the reason Dr. King was bent over, because in that sermon, that eulogy, he dared to still hold on to his prophetic edge and raise the question about who really killed them.
Mm-hmm.
And then he had to do that with Jimmie Lee Jackson, who really killed him. And then he had to do that with James Reed, who really killed him. I mean, it's like constantly King was not saying, I'm not just coming and doing this eulogy and act as though this is natural. This is unnatural. This is the result of a lot of people. In those sermons, he would even criticize black people who were on the sidelines and politicians who weren't using their power right. And he would say, look, it's not so much, you know, what, but who.
Mm.
Who killed them? And when you do that, you do walk away kind of heavy, because this world has a strange hatred for truth. You know, truth is the only thing that sets us free. And yet we hate it. So, you know. Our hymns say, I think, you know, America, America, God shed thy grace on thee. There's the second verse said, America, America, God shed thy grace on thee. And then it says, and mend thine every flaw. We don't want to sing that second verse, because we're stuck in the lie of a kind of exceptionalism that doesn't even make sense. Because if we had the kind of exceptionalism that we often hear people talking about, we would be God.
Mm.
And last time I checked, we're not God. Or close to God. I mean, we got so much repentance in our founding documents. So I often believe that sometimes the Holy Spirit got a hold of something. They didn't know what they were writing. You know, like in the Declaration of Independence, it actually tells us that when the nation strays from life, liberty, and pursuit of happiness, the people have a responsibility after a long chain of abuse. That's the language. When you've had a long chain of abuse, you have the responsibility to change that. Or the Constitution, when it says, you know, in order to have a more perfect union, well, if you are trying to have a more perfect union, that is admitting you're not perfect. That is, mm-hmm. That's admitting you got great flaws. As Thurgood Marshall once said, a great thing about the Constitution is that it could be amended. Mm. So where are we now? We got a lot of amendments to do, Doc.
You better go ahead, Doc.
We got a lot of a floor. We still are in that place that Dr. King spoke of when he said we got the high blood pressure of creeds, but the anemia of deeds. And you and I have talked about this. I preached a sermon at a National Cathedral this past year. I think it was around June 14th, just before we gathered 2.7 million people online for the Mass Poor People's Assembly Mall March on Washington. We had planned to be in the streets, but we couldn't because of COVID. And our public health advisor said it would have been totally irresponsible for us to put poor, lower people who already don't have health care, who are already more acceptable to the spread of this disease because of how it spreads in the fissures of poverty and racism, to then put them in the street. So we didn't do that, but we went online. But the Sunday before I was at the National Cathedral, and I couldn't get away from dealing with death. I called you, mm-hmm. and I said, and so the sermon was, America has to decide that death is no longer an option, that she's going to deal with the history of necropolitics, all the ways in which policies have produced so much death, and not just COVID. And I walked through how I said in the sermon, there's a DM on the DL in every piece of racist, class-based public place of politics. There's a death measurement on the down low. And until we face this and own it and repent of it and cry out again, it's going to continue to exist. So for instance, where are we? We're in the midst of COVID, where we have 3,000 people now dying a day. We have nearly 300,000 people who have died. We know that 210,000 of them potentially didn't have to die because it's studied by Columbia. We know that it's both the inept criminal response to COVID of Trump, but McConnell and all of those other senators and others that would rather give 84% of the money in the first act to corporations and banks rather than to the people who are essential enough to keep this country alive, but not essential enough to live themselves. Mm-hmm. That's what they're saying to people. You are essential enough to work. It's like you're like the slaves that Pharaoh made make bricks with straw. You're going to build this pyramid, but if you die doing it, we're just going to push you aside and get somebody else. I mean, you think about it, that's where we are. But where were we before that? Enabled this to exist. You see, it's not like this could not exist if there had not been a misshaping of our consciousness to allow it to exist. So prior to COVID, 700 people were dying a day from poverty,
right?
But no outcry. Thousands of people were dying a year from the lack of health care. 250,000 people were dying from poverty and low wealth. No outcry. Yes, we have people killing folk with police killing, but it's worse than the police person hanging somebody by the knee or lynching somebody. It is the system of the state killing folk in my name. Because when a police officer kills someone, that's like the state backing up state-sponsored murder. Because that's in my name, Doc. That's in your name. Mm-hmm. They don't operate. They don't get their power. I often tell somebody, you know, the police is the only group, the only people that can come to your door in the middle of the night, knock on your door, show you a piece of paper, and walk out with your wife or your child. And you say, baby, I'll be there. I'll call the lawyer. I'll come down there and get you. Mm-hmm. That's what you're going to say. Because if they pull that gun, that's about the best things you're going to say. Otherwise, you're going to be dead. Mm-hmm. They're the only folk who do that. But they get that from our name. The state sues. It's the state of North Carolina versus so-and-so. So it's yes, the killing of individuals, but it's this system that says certain folks' bodies are destructible. And we can justify it in policies, whether it be the bad policies that undergird police brutality or health care or denial of living wages, so forth and so on. And for so long, our consciousness of this country has been so misshaped that the death of certain people is okay. And it runs through, it's like it's a through line through the history and sociology of this nation. Mm-hmm. And America, where are we? We, this moment is going to make us decide if death is still going to be an option. If necropolitics is going to be allowed to have this kind of power, this kind of passion, and this kind of penetration into the lives of people without protest.
You know, Bishop, when, you know, I was just thinking as you were talking, you know, because it's important mm-hmm. to think about the reality of death and then necropolitics. Because, mm-hmm. you know, the modern U.S. nation state came into existence on the backs of death. I mean, in the midst of unimaginable carnage. When you think about the Civil War, and the death that, you know, as Drew Faust put it in the Republic of Suffering, the death that ushered in what became the modern U.S. nation state. The death became the basis for a certain kind of union among white men in particular. But, you know, it's almost as if death has been privatized in this moment with COVID. You, know, you just deal with your own grief. No public rituals,
nothing.
No communal acknowledgement for the most part. You just on your own to deal with this kind
of. If you are of a certain people, see, because this is the other thing about this death reality. And you said the death that the Republic was built on, which means. When we keep talking about the foundations of the nation, we have to understand that cement is mixed with blood.
Yes, sir.
You don't mix cement with water. And in a nation, you should be mixing the cement with truth and love and justice. So on the one hand, we say that on paper, but if you crack open the cement, it's full of blood. It's the blood of my native brothers and sisters, where I have a speech I talk about where one Methodist minister who was a general told the troops, kill them all. This was a group of natives, kill every one of them, even the children, women, because gnats make nits. Right. And we've never owned that, which is why we don't want to have a ritual now. See, that's why. See, the reason why we're not having a ritual now is because we've never had a ritual then. The reason why I don't want to own the death now is because we've never really owned the death before. We've never really told the truth. And so we've got all of this blood in the cement of the nation, which keeps it cracked because I'm a Mason, it's untempered mortar, Doc. It's untempered mortar that we have used. See, and so that's why there's got to be a third reconstruction. That's why there has to be a redoing, right? And that's going to start with some of it's got to be torn down. Because even the way we're talking about this, and I have to catch myself. Think about it, Eddie. We say people are dying from COVID, nearly 300,000 people. Black people are dying 3 and 5 times more likely, and Hispanics 3 and 5 times more likely. And even if you and I are not careful, we end up participating in the lie. Because that's not who's dying.
That's right.
Poor low wealth black folk are dying.
That's right.
People who work in face-to-face jobs who were deemed essential. See, before COVID, they were service workers. After COVID, they're essential because they're essential for other folk to live their lives of private quarantine and wealth. You know, they got to have their meat. They have to have so-and-so. So you make them work. You don't protect them. Then you try to pass immunity laws for the corporation that didn't protect them. And I just found out from my daughter, who's a public health specialist, PhD graduate from Harvard, they're not keeping the stats on poverty. So even when we keep saying black folk are dying, that even is not true. It's black folk, but it's poor, low wealth black people. It's black people that's working in the face-to-face. And we say there's a recession. Well, there's not just a recession, because normal recessions start in the manufacturing industry and radiate out. This recession is starting among hospitality areas where it doesn't normally start. 30 million people have lost their job, but it's not just 30 million people. It's the majority of the people who were already making less than a living wage, who were already facing hard times, who didn't have the health care and the medical leave and the sick leave and the unemployment, who worked on jobs but didn't have the power through unions to demand even safe workplaces before COVID. So even you and me as scholars, we have to catch ourselves. Because this death reality of this society will have us saying things that is not the whole truth and nothing but the truth.
That's right. Right? That's right. Yes,
and if we keep telling the lie, we keep getting the same results. You know, because as you said, if you just stop for a minute, you got that. What, how in the world can you not at least have a national eulogy with all this death? You know, we did one on the day, the week before Thanksgiving, the Poor People's Campaign. And, but how do you do this? Because it's been done before. And we never said it was wrong then, because the privatization of the death has a race class privatization of it.
Yeah,
it's intentional privatization of death.
That's right.
It's not like I just want to be by myself. I'm forced by myself.
Mm.
Right.
My Lord. So let me, you know, I can't, you know, you are a preacher of the gospel. It is clear, right, that you know, there is not the blood in the cement that animates your life, Doc. It's the blood on the cross. Come on. So what do you do as a Christian? What do you say in response to those in the name of the gospel, sacralize this mess, sanctify this mess? How do you respond to them on Christian grounds, Doc?
I want to be more and more like Jesus. Now, what does that mean? We're headed into the Christmas season. And the original Christmas season had nothing to do with tinkly, tinkly, tinkly and lights and stuff. It was a battle at Bethlehem. A battle between justice and injustice, murder and life. If you slow down and read the Christmas text, Jesus was born in a time just like this, which means the church is born. People of faith are born for this moment if we will accept the mantle. The Gospel of Matthew says, and the word came to Joseph in the days of Herod. Herod was a narcissistic, murderous, necropolitics believing and loving ruler who controlled the press and the Senate, who gave his own form of disinformation, who was so ruthless that he killed babies because he was afraid of the prophecy of Micah that a Messiah was coming that would pull down those in power who were hurting the poor and the least of these. And yet that's the very moment God came, God moved. And if that's who we follow, this is the very moment we must move. When you get to the public life of Jesus, Herod's still out there. His son is out there, is carrying on. I love the Bible story because it lets us know, don't ever blame all this mess on one Herod or one Trump. Because when Jesus is 30 years old, the original Herod is dead. They tried to kill him when he was a baby. But now there's another Herod on the throne. They're trying to kill him. But what does Jesus do? He lays out a public policy agenda for transformation. First sermon, he says, look, ain't but one way out of this mess. You got to have politics that provide good news for the poor. And the poor there are the potokos, those who've been made poor by the policies of society. You got to heal the brokenhearted, those who've had their lives broken because of the politics of Herod. You got to give recovery of sight to the blind. You got to have a way of helping people see beyond the moment and see the moment, not just see beyond it, but see it. And then have a prophetic imagination that's greater than the current moment. You've got to release the captives, those who've been captive by the complexes of prison or the mentality of imprisonment or captive by the policies of Herod. And then you've got to declare the acceptable year of the Lord, which literally means say in the midst of this mess, Jubilee is still possible. And what is Jubilee? It is the ancient concept of the day when debts are forgiven, when justice comes, when rulers are put in their place. And so if that's what Jesus did in that moment, in that Christmas, this Christmas, I preached a sermon years ago called Lord Bless Us, I Wish You a Mourning Christmas, an M-O-U-R-N-I-N-G. Mm-hmm. Blessed are the day who mourn. Because the concept of mourn, according to Howard Thurman, is not just crying personal tears. It's being moved to a point that you do something. It's being moved to a point that you say, no, I'm not taking this no more, and I'm not allowing it to happen to my brothers and sisters. Blessed are those folk who are mourning, because they will be comforted. They will receive help. They will get a paraclete. They will get assistance from God to change what's causing the mourning. And so in this moment, we must have a recentering. You and I talked about this the other day. Like people have said, well, we need this person in position. No, the question is, who's at the center of your vision? Because if the poor and the sick and the unemployed and those facing eviction are not at the center of your position, your vision, you will misuse your position because nothing's guiding you. So what we say in this moment, what we're pushing on, you know, we've got a meeting soon with the Biden transition team. And we say, okay, you say you want to heal the nation? Really? In this moment of our own contemporary Herod philosophy of destruction and lies, then here's what you got to do. First 50 days, you got to enact comprehensive, free, just COVID relief, covers testing, treatment, vaccines, direct payments to the poor, support for public schools. You've got to guarantee quality health care. You got to have housing for all. You can't let 30 million people go into evictions. You got to raise the minimum wage to $15 an hour now. You got to guarantee quality health care. You got to protect people from pre-existing conditions. You got to raise, you got to update the poverty measures, because we keep telling ourselves a lie about poverty measures because we're using a measurement that's 55 years old that was wrong when it was first created. You got to guarantee housing for all. You got to enact a federal jobs program to build up investments, infrastructure, public institutions, deals with climate resilience and climate injustice. We have to protect and expand voting rights and civil rights. You got to guarantee quality public education, protection against resegregation. We have to have comprehensive and just immigration reform, ensure the rights of all indigenous people, enact fair taxes and give tax credits for children to disabled and poor working families, use the power of executive orders to overturn all this foolishness we've seen that can be done. And then you've got to redirect and the bloated Pentagon budget toward these priorities that are really about national security. If you want healing, now, if you just want to talk about healing, don't do this. If healing is just some folks shaking hands that weren't shaking hands a few years ago, but they still are engaged in the same kind of politics of compromise, which, you know, compromise down there, it has been bad, three-fifths mm-hmm. compromise. So, you know, compromise is capitulation most of the time, because the people who get compromised on are the people who were already compromised before the compromise.
You better preach.
You know what I'm saying?
Absolutely.
So if you're serious about healing, healing can never be spacious and ooey, some kind of spirit, some kind of false
sentimentality.
No. It's got to, and you got to do it now. And they say, well, we can wait. You can't wait, because waiting, we're in the midst of this. The destruction is growing, and it's been around a long time. And if you're serious about it, people didn't vote for you to wait. And Jesus didn't wait. In the Christmas season, that's what it's about. There comes a time God must break in. There comes a time justice must break in. It doesn't care if Herod is still on the throne. It doesn't care if Herod gets another term. It has to break in. The stars of heaven have to show a light on the injustice. You got to go gather the people that otherwise aren't used, like shepherds, those that are pushed to the edge. You got to reach down in the ghetto and pick up a savior, because the only folk that can change the nation are the rejected people from Nazareth, the ghetto, like Mary and like Joseph. There comes a time there must be a battle. It's not so much about unity, it's about what side you're on. Because there are necessary divisions for healing to take place. What do I mean by that? We started with grandmama. When you would get a ball back in the day on your hand, grandma would say, come here, let me lance it. Grandma said, come here, let me lance it. She cut it open. There was a necessary division to get that pus out, right? Uh-huh. And then she squeezed it real hard. And it hurt, man, it hurt. And then grandma would stick some, get a Q-tip or something, put some alcohol and clean it. And it would hurt, but she was going all the way down to the bottom, because she knew you can't heal a wound by just doing surface stuff.
That's right.
You got
that's
to heal right. it all the way from the bottom. And that's what we must do. And that's what people of faith must do. In Jesus came in the days of Herod. Our protest, our faith, our commit fictions, our truth, our love, our grace, our mercy, our power, all of it is for this moment. Mm. This is a Christmas moment for America, but not the normal kind of Christmas we've become sentimental about. This is the call to nonviolent arms. This is the call for justice and love and truth to say, Herod will no longer have the stage alone.
Right.
Herod and the politics of Herod and the politics of death. Mm-mm. You've tried to kill us, and you may try to kill us now. You may try to push us down. You may try to lie and blame us for your losing in certain elections, but this is today. And I wrote a little book on it called We Are Called to Be a Movement. Do you realize if the rejected people who are being rejected by all of this, these neoliberalism, trickle down, all this necropolitics, if the rejected people, regardless of race, creed, and color, deal with these issues and come together, there comes a time, and even in the biblical writing, Eddie, that mm-hmm. Herod is no longer discussed. See, Herod has a historical day, but if the people come together right in the spirit, Herod doesn't have the last say. Herod gets defeated by a little pregnant girl from the ghetto and a little baby raised in the ghetto of Nazareth who was born without health care. But the spirit was on him that brought all these folk together, beginning with the poor. And do you know, if you deal with the issue of poverty and wealth, low wealth, and you connect that to race, that's the only way you're going to really get at dealing with the issue of structural racism. Because at the end of the day, racism, as Ibram Kendi first said, even the outward forms of racism, you know, the name calling was the cover for the policy and the economic goals. Racism in this country has always had an economic goal.
Yeah. So Doc, you know, because I don't want to keep you too much, but there are two things that I want to, as we come bring this to a close, because you've been filling my spirit in so many ways. I wish they could see us, because, you know, I get to shout when I'm talking to you.
Both of us do. So, you my preacher and I'm your doc.
And so, and you know, I'm going to go back to one of our conversations, because we started shouting the other day on the phone when we were talking about vision and who's at the center of your vision. And you went to Mark 8, verse 22 through 26 on me.
Oh, Lord.
And I think it's so important for you to talk about, you know, that moment when Jesus healed the blind man. He had to touch him twice.
Yeah. Yeah.
As you were recounting this moment, one of, you know, this moment of Jesus's miracles, right? As you were recounting it to me, you were offering a lesson that actually fed into all of what you've just laid out in terms of this emphasis on policy, this moment, this Herod moment that calls us to be in a certain sort of way, to bear witness. So talk a little bit about that verse and what it means in this moment. At least I was running around the house after I hung up the phone with you. I just want you to
know. You know, I tell my friends who don't, they may not believe the Bible is a book of faith, but there's still some pretty good literature and philosophy and truth in there. But let me come at it this way, because you see, while we have to be critical of Herod, we have to be critical of the systems that are supposed to stand against Herod that have too long have stood with Herod. You know, Jesus was the first sermon that Jesus preached talking about the poor, the ghetto turned on him. The leaders that were there prior to him coming turned on him. Mm-hmm. Just like when Dr. King started talking about poverty, militarism, and racism together, 150 newspapers wrote articles against him, and almost every civil rights organization wrote resolutions against him.
Somebody died at the National Baptist Convention as a result of this, right?
All right.
Think about the progressive Baptist. Okay, right. we get okay. Right.
And so you can't see Herod has to be given license to do what Herod does, because you can't rule a people unless they give you so much license to do it. And sometimes, you know, that's why the religious leaders, those who believe they were the ones to deal with the people, speak for the people, they hated the prophetic movement of Jesus, just like they hated the movement of the prophets. I had a professor at Drew that told me the prophets only rose when the leaders that were supposed to be doing what they needed to be doing weren't doing it. That's the only time Isaiah, Micah rise up. They don't just rise up. They rise up when even the structures of protest that are supposed to take on the injustice aren't doing what they're supposed to do. Or they're just doing a little bit, but not doing the full measure of it. Now, having said that, in the Gospel of Mark, which I love the Gospel of Mark, because it's when Jesus in Mark's Gospel, I think it's Mark, no, it's Matthew's actually, but it's in Mark, I believe, as well. When Jesus sees this man that's blind, he touches him. Now, this is Jesus. This is not just anybody. And he says, how do you see now? And the man says, I see men as trees. And then Jesus says, oh, you need another touch. Now, right there is what we call a messianic contradiction. You ain't supposed to be touched by God and still need another touch. But the only way you can understand that is you can actually ask God for healing, but not want it all the way. Mm. Like America can ask to come out of COVID, but really not want to come out all the way. I mean, the Senate just showed us that because of the bill. They want to come out, but they don't want to come out all the way right. You need a second touch. And Jesus says, you see people as trees, touched by God, but you may be touched by God, but whatever touch you got is not enough, because you can't say you know God and see people as trees, because trees are transactional. unanimated objects. You cut trees down. You burn trees for fire. You sit under trees for shade. But you don't have to live with the tree and love the tree and see the tree as a part of who you are. You when you see men as trees, you see some folk as other. So they don't matter except for what they can do for you in a moment, essential workers. But you still can expend them because you see them as trees. It's a heavy theological piece. And it doesn't matter if you put your hand on the Bible and swear when you go in the office. You need another touch.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir.
You see what I'm saying? It's like when Harriet Tubman, remember in the movie Harriet recently, and the people who had been freedmen up in the North, they were talking about not going back to the South. And Harriet said, some of you have never known what it knows, what it's like to be slave. I'm going back. You need another touch. She was talking to black folk. If you make this abolition movement too bougie, you need another touch. So it's not just about the opposition. There come moments, but then we settle for these transactional relations. We settle for seeing some people as that they matter and other folk really don't matter. America has had to have at least two touches since her beginning. We call them reconstructions.
Yes, sir.
She had a war, and while slavery ended, after the war, she needed another touch. Wasn't enough to have a 13th Amendment. Had to have a 14th Amendment, which saved the Constitution. Because without the 14th Amendment, no women's rights, no disability rights, right? No civil rights, equal protection of law. That's another touch. You need the 15th Amendment, another touch. Because you can't, before then, you still only had white men with land that could vote. Mm-hmm. Women couldn't vote. They still didn't until 1920. She needed another touch, right? Civil rights movement. You know, in the early 1900s, America needed another touch because of the monopolies and the wealth. So here comes the social gospel movement, Walter Rauschenbusch. They raised the question, WWJD, what would Jesus do? Not what would Jesus do in terms of people's personal sin, but if Jesus saw children walking around with three fingers cut off because they're being forced to work in factories, what would Jesus do? If Jesus saw men being forced to work 60 and 80 hours a week in places with no ventilation, what would Jesus do? And the social gospel movement was so powerful, it touched Teddy Roosevelt. And in 1912, he makes that bull speech where he lays down these seven moral things that America has to do, and he gets on both parties saying you need another touch. Right? Come out of the Great Depression. We need another touch. We need a New Deal. But then the New Deal didn't go but so far because when Social Security was first passed, black folk and white people, white women for the most part, couldn't access it because the agrarian culture and those in the domestic culture were not allowed to pay in until 1954. 1954, we need another touch because we're still seeing some folk as trees. So we got Jim Crow, separate but equal.
We're going to work that thing, Doc.
You know, Thurgood Marshall and some Jewish lawyers and white lawyers. And look, over against some black people that told him to leave it alone. There were black folk that told Thurgood Marshall, leave this alone. We can bargain this out to get a little bit more money for our schools. And Thurgood, it's not just about you getting a little money. It's about this is not right fundamentally. It destroys both the white and the black. Gives one a false sense of inferiority, the other false sense of superiority. We need another touch. Emmett Till gets killed. Mamie Till says, America needs another touch. I'm going to let y'all see my baby. I'm going to let you see his picture of what he was before racism. I'm going to let you see the picture after racism because you need another touch. And Rosa got touched. I can't take this no more. 1963. After the march on Washington, everybody's happy. Wow, pow, look at this. All these folk get together. 17 days later, we're blowing up babies in Sunday school. America needs another touch because we still are othering people. We still are seeing too many people as trees. And Jesus gave the man another touch. And he said, now how do you see men? He said, I see men as men. I see people as people. Until America sees people as people, until we stop putting clauses, exclusion clauses. Yeah. In our Constitution and in our document. And still we stop trying to find people to exclude. I told one of our civil rights groups one time, we got to change our ways. We charging too much for our banquets because the folk we claim we standing for can't even come.
Ooh, Doc.
We treat folk like trees.
Oh, Lord.
We want them to buy the membership, but we don't want them to be in the leadership. When we start talking to the Biden campaign, it's one of them said, well, we'll meet with you and one or two more. I said, I can't accept that meeting. They said, why? I said, because we want to bring the people. We want to bring impact to people, the white farmer, the white person from Appalachia, the black person from Alabama, the fast food worker. They said, that's a lot of people, but we don't see men as trees. See, if you keep them out the room, you're engaging in one of the most sinful theological flaws. That the number one sin in the Bible is idolatry. The number two sin in the Bible is mistreatment of the poor and the least of these and acting as though they don't matter. Now, we say the same thing in our founding documents, but we don't see the same thing. And we need another touch. And that's why the Poor People Campaign is not going anywhere. That's not how we're organizing, because our work in this season is to guarantee that America needs another touch. Now, I have suspicion it'll need another touch sometime later. But while we're here, we have to touch her one more time.
Oh, thank God. Thank God. Well, Doc, I'm sitting here trying to keep myself together. Thank God for your grandmother. Because in those dark moments when you need to commune, to fortify your spirit so that you can come out here and say those words, I know she's wrapping you in her arms, brother, mm-hmm. loving you to death.
Mm-hmm. Beautiful woman, Doc.
Indeed. Those clouds of witnesses, man. Oh, my Lord.
Say something. She didn't get but a fifth grade education. But when she looked at me and said, boy, don't you never dismiss nobody. Mm. I read Jurgen Moltmann. I read King. I read Walter Rauschenbusch. I read Paul Tillich, The Courage to Be. But my greatest theologian was Grandma saying, don't you never mistreat nobody and claim to love Jesus.
My Lord. And that's our message. Thank you so much. And, you know, I'm going to keep you in my prayers. And we're going
to thank you, Doc.
All right, man.
Thank you so much.
To support this show and DubLab's progressive programming, go to dublab.com/support.